MacCast, Sunday, January 20th, 2019. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be back here with you. Another week has gone by. That means we have another bit of Apple and Mac news to get to. Also, some of your feedbacks, your feedbacks. That was weird. Your feedback, rather, your comments, your questions. And also, I have a little tip. Actually, I guess it's not so much a tip as it's a cool little thing that I figured out how to do that I want to share with you. I don't know how super useful it is, but I thought it was pretty neat. So I guess stupid Mac tricks, maybe the better term for that. But we are going to get into some Apple stuff. We're going to talk about Apple Music a little bit. We're going to talk about iPhone upgrades, Apple getting a little bit more pushy about those. Also, rumors of new Apple hardware. We'll get into that. Also, some potential Apple hardware for the future. Talk about Apple's vice president and where he might end up. And it might not be at Apple. And also, we've got some new Apple hardware that actually Apple shipped this last week to discuss. That will round out the news. And then, like I said, we're going to get into a little project that I did over the weekend and played around with that I thought was pretty cool. We're going to talk about duplicates in Spotlight and how you might be able to clean those up, and then get into the mysteries of NVRAM. Yeah, if you've been wondering about that, you probably haven't, but we will get into it in there and talk about that a little bit. And that should round out this episode of the MacCast. Oh, we also have one of the augmented reality application recommendations for you. So that will round out this episode of the MacCast. So I just want to dive right into the news. I don't want to waste any more time this week. We're going to talk about Apple Music and HomePod streaming limits. Did you know there was a limit on the number of Apple Music streams you could have if you have a single user account? Well, if you didn't, you are not alone, because there are a few other people that didn't realize that limit existed either, and it maybe didn't. We're not really sure if Apple screwed up on this one or not, but if you have a HomePod and a single user Apple Music account, seems like recently people are reporting they lost the ability to play two different streams simultaneously. So apparently it used to be that you could play Apple Music to an iOS device and then also stream a different song or have someone else in your household stream music to a HomePod. And there was never any problem with that. But sometime over the past couple weeks, at least sometime into 2019, it appears that functionality went away, and it's not clear if it should have even been possible in the first place. All this came about in a Reddit thread. I'll link to that in the show notes at maccast.com, because it has a few more details and comments from various people, so if you really want to read through this. But basically, one user said in that thread that they were told by Apple support that it must have been a bug, because they shouldn't have had that ability. So what it means is that now, if you want to be able to stream multiple streams to multiple devices, you need to make sure that you upgrade to a family plan, because the family plan allows you to stream up to six simultaneous Apple Music streams. But if you do have a single user plan, you are only allowed to stream a single stream. And I couldn't confirm any of this because I do have a family plan in my house. But apparently, if you start playing a stream on your iPhone now, and then someone else tries to play another stream on a HomePod, the iPhone stream will actually be stopped. And some people are even reporting that you will get a pop-up telling you that if you want to stream multiple streams, you need to upgrade to that family plan. Now, as far as it, you know, was this a change? Is this a feature that Apple took away? It doesn't appear to be that, because I did go in and check Apple Music's terms of service, and it definitely clearly states, quote, an individual Apple Music membership allows you to stream on a single device at a time. A family membership allows you or your family members to stream on up to 6 devices at a time. So if you do need that ability to stream to 2 different things at the same time, you are going to unfortunately have to upgrade to an Apple Music Family subscription, which is going to cost you $15 US per month, as opposed to the $9.99 a month of the single plan. As you might know, Apple's iPhone sales this year have been a little bit slow, especially those holiday sales, especially sales of those new devices, the iPhone XS, XS Max, and XR. And Apple is sort of scrambling to try and get us to upgrade our iOS devices. They've definitely kicked marketing into overdrive in an attempt to try and convince you owners of those older devices to upgrade. We heard about this week emails going out. I think this has happened in the past, but Apple, you know, again, sending out emails that are specifically targeted at those of you who have not upgraded your iPhones this year, and including kind of personalized information based on your registrations on things like how much you could get for trade-in on your existing device, or how much better the specs of that new iPhone XR would be if you would just upgrade. So Apple trying very hard to convince you that you need an iPhone. Part of the problem, as we've talked about a little bit here on the MacCast, at least according to Apple and Tim Cook, is that their $29 battery replacement program last year was very, very popular. A lot of you went out and just upgraded the batteries in your phones and then decided, you know what, I don't need to upgrade because this thing's working just great. It works fine. iOS 12 is rocking. They improved performance in iOS 12, and I'm feeling pretty good about my existing phone. One thing we didn't know, though, was how many of you took advantage of that battery replacement program, and John Gruber this week got some numbers. Apparently, there was an all-hands meeting that took place at Apple's campus on January 3rd, and during that meeting, Tim Cook said that Apple replaced about 11 million batteries under the $29 battery replacement program. Now, how does that compare to a typical year of battery replacements? Well, that is actually 5 to 10 times the normal number or normal volume of battery replacement. So Apple did replace a lot of batteries, and I have no doubt that that is making an impact in those upgrades. We also continue to hear reports from Apple's suppliers that those iPhone sales have not been doing well either, based on what they're saying about their expected earnings, and particularly sales in China seem to be being blamed over and over again. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, TSMC, who supplies the bulk of Apple's A-series chips for their iPhones, did say they're expecting about a 22% drop in revenue for the January to March quarter. So that's quite a big hit. Also, Nidec, who supplies Apple's Taptic Engine Vibration Motor, they say they're expecting about a 25% drop in profits for the year. And then finally, Apple's manufacturing partner, Foxconn, has had to let go about 50,000 of its seasonal workers much earlier than expected. It sounds like they were starting to let them go in October, and typically they'd be keeping those workers around until almost January and then starting to scale back. So that's happening a lot quicker. All of these seem to be signs pointing to the fact that iPhone sales have been very slow this year. Although I do think it's a bit bold to assume that everything we're seeing in the supply chain is just because of Apple and the iPhone. A lot of these companies also do supply components to other other smartphone manufacturers, rather, and all of smartphones are taking a hit. I think as, again, smartphones have matured, and I think consumers in general, iPhone, Android, or otherwise, are just holding on to their devices a bit longer. They're lasting a bit longer and servicing folks' needs a bit longer. So I think It's just a natural progression, and companies are going to have to adapt, Apple included, and I think Apple is already planning for this. We've talked about it on some other episodes of the MacCast. And then last little interesting thing with iPhone sales this week, surprisingly over the weekend, if you wanted to pick up an iPhone SE, you might have been able to do so because they resurfaced on Apple's website in the United States. Yes, a discontinued product showing back up, at least in the clearance section. There were units available in the clearance section. They were priced at $249 US for a 32 gigabyte model. What was going on, though, is not a resurgence of Apple bringing back the iPhone SE in the US. It looks like they were just trying to liquidate out any remaining inventory. And they definitely did go fast because as of this recording on Sunday evening, they no longer appear to be available in the Apple Store. So if you're hearing about this now, you probably missed out if you wanted an iPhone SE. Now, it did bring up some resurging rumors that, hey, maybe if Apple is selling the iPhone SE again, maybe they're thinking about doing an iPhone SE 2. I say it's not out of the realm of possibility, but that isn't a solid rumor we're hearing at this point. As of now, the only place I think where you can get an iPhone SE and where Apple is still manufacturing and selling iPhone SEs is over in India. So don't expect it to come back, but it was interesting to see it pop up on Apple's website over the weekend. Here's something we don't hear about too frequently anymore, iPods. What do you think about a new updated iPod Touch? And maybe that iPod Touch having USB-C instead of a Lightning connector. Now, I'm taking all of this with a grain of salt because, again, the source is the supply chain. But Mac Takahara says that an updated iPod Touch is in the works from Apple. They also claim that this year's iPhones are going to dump the Lightning connectors and pick up USB-C, just like this year's iPad Pros. Now, that rumor I don't think is too big of a stretch. I think Apple will eventually do that. The question in my mind is, will they do it in 2019, or will they wait until 2020? And I'm sort of on the fence on that one, at least when it comes to the iPhone. Now, the iPod Touch, that might be a whole different animal, and I could see Apple sort of redoing that. Of course, this report out of Mac Takahara does not mention any specific details on any of this, especially the iPod Touch, and they don't talk about a change in design, anything like that. But I thought, you know, now that I'm thinking about this, what would Apple do with an update to the iPod Touch, considering it was last updated in 2015? I think it's pretty safe to assume that we will see an upgraded processor. The current model uses an A8, which is pretty long in the tooth. I'd like to see them at least update that to an A10, but it would be nice if they brought it fully into the modern age and gave it an A12. Would they add a true depth camera system, get rid of the Touch ID, and go with more of an iPhone, a current iPhone design with an edge-to-edge display? I think that's something we would like to see them do, although I don't put much stock in it because the iPod Touch is going to be more of an entry-level device. So I think they may stick with the older Touch ID technology. The question would be, are they still going to maybe try to expand out the display and the design a little bit? That I really don't know. And then the last question in my mind is, would they up the storage? Currently, they sell a 32 gigabyte and a 128 gigabyte model. It would be really nice to see them bump that up to 64 and 256. But if you look at Apple's entry-level iPhones, the iPhone 7s and the iPhone 8s, or at least the iPhone 7, it is at 32 and 128. So I think they may keep those storage sizes and keep the pricing at $199 US and $299 US respectively. The piece does point out that the iPod Touch is still a pretty good entry point product for a lot of customers, especially in light of Apple transitioning over to a heavier focus on their services. So they definitely want to continue to update that product, especially with their upcoming video streaming service on the horizon, right? Apple wants to sell more services, so having more devices that can support those services in the marketplace is a good thing. I think there's a lot of parents out there too, who maybe get iPod touches for their kids who aren't quite ready for cell phones yet. And I think also people who just want an alternative to an iPhone, that is a great product. And hopefully Apple will continue to update it. Oh, the other thing I think we would get is, of course, because that's one of Apple's last colorful products, we would get refreshed and updated colors. Apple seems to like to do that from time to time, maybe making them a little more, I would say, seasonal, but the iPod Touch doesn't really come out seasonally. I guess just generational in terms of the colors, and we've seen them roll through a bunch of different ones. I don't know what they could do this time around to make them a little bit different. It'd be kind of fun to see them go back to like deep, rich colors, sort of like remember when Apple changed the iMac colors from the sort of bright ones to it was almost like a dark sapphire blue and a ruby red, and they had a dark green one. More in that sort of color palette might be very, very interesting. But regardless, it looks like we might get an updated iPod Touch sometime soon. We're also starting to hear more rumors about what the next generation of iPhone might look like. For lack of a better term, I think we'll just call it for now the iPhone 11. We don't know officially what Apple is going to call it, but we've been seeing some prototypes surfacing from sources like OnLeaks, and this week they surfaced a second prototype. It actually came up in a blog called Compare Raja, which I think is out of India, and it shows an interesting centered rear camera bump. So an actual oval rear camera bump right in the middle of the iPhone. It still has three lenses like the earlier prototype we talked about last week, and I think it looks much, much better than the Ritz camera bump. If you remember from the last episode of the MacCast, the other version, the other prototype, had a giant square camera bump that I said, you know, in my mind looks almost like a cracker. Really, really ugly. So this design, I think, is much, much better. The center lens actually has a flash ring around it, which I think is really neat as well. So rather than having a little flash off to the side of the lenses, it's right around that center lens. The report claims that two of the cameras are 10 megapixel and 14 megapixel sensors, respectively. They didn't have any information, or we didn't get any info on the third camera lens, what the resolution there would be. They also note that the notch on the front would be reduced in size and also contain a 10 megapixel true depth camera. So nice little bump up on the FaceTime camera as well. And the current prototypes that we're seeing still do have a lightning connector. That doesn't necessarily mean that that is what Apple is going with when they actually release, but it's looking like for now, at least with prototypes, they're sticking with lightning. So there you have that. And then the only other thing we're hearing with regards to future iPhones is something related to the iPhone XR. There was a report this week that the iPhone XR update might add better cellular connectivity with an updated LTE 4x4 multi-in, multi-out antenna. So 4x4 MIMO antenna, that would be like what is in the iPhone XS and XS Plus currently. The current version of the iPhone XR just has a 2x2. So that would increase and improve, I think, both Wi-Fi and cellular connectivity on the next version. Again, not a huge sort of, you know, like shocking rumor, but just something else that surfaced this week. And then finally, we also did hear a little bit more about potential iPad updates. We continue to hear more rumors from various sources about a new iPad mini, that there's going to be a bump there, and also that they're still expecting a planned update in the first half of 2019 of the entry-level iPad 9.7-inch models. Not a lot of details being thrown around at this point beyond just spec bumps, you know, updates to the processors, although Ming-Chi Kuo did say that the iPad mini would have a cheaper display panel, meaning that might actually come down in price. Right now, the iPad Mini 4 is actually more expensive than the 9.7-inch iPad, which just seems crazy to me. So it would make sense for Apple to maybe bring some of the component costs down and adjust that pricing a little bit. There was also at least one Chinese report that mentioned the 7.9-inch model maybe being replaced by a 10-inch version that would presumably take on some of the design cues from the iPad Pros, so having those squared edges. It's not clear if it would have a edge-to-edge display and the TrueDepth camera system replacing the Face ID, but I think, again, because it's an entry-level model, that's going to be a hard thing for Apple to pull off and still keep the pricing relatively low versus the Pro models. So we'll have to wait and see on this one, but it is expected to happen sometime in the first half of 2019. I'm guessing around the April or May timeframe. What do you think about when I say Apple Power Glove? Yep, not a lost accessory from the Apple Pippin. Actually, this is a patent thing. I don't discuss Apple patents on the show too much because there are usually a ton of different patents that Apple puts out there, and most of them don't become actual products. But this week, one surfaced that I thought was pretty interesting, so I wanted to bring it up to you and talk to you about it. It is for a fabric-based devices, or for fabric-based devices, rather, with force sensing. So not just a glove, but maybe a myriad of different things made out of fabric with force sensing sensors in them to be used as different kinds of user interfaces for computing. And this gets interesting to me because I think we are moving to a computing future where there is a lot more computing that would happen without traditional input devices, things we're used to like mice and keyboards, and yes, even now, touchscreens. I think you're going to need to have some way to interface or interact with a computer that goes beyond those things. And we've already started to play around with voice interfaces, things like Siri and Alexa and all of our different digital assistants, and those are getting better and better. But I think we still are going to need some alternatives that use our appendages, our digits, our fingers, and maybe other body parts. Yeah, let's not go too far down that path. But this patent basically describes a glove or other wearable that would have force sensing circuitry inside of it, and this would allow the clothing to detect forces and trigger commands when you touch a surface or when you grab an object, for example, and then the computer could actually do something. Sensors and gloves would be used for things like typing on a surface or maybe initiating gestures in the air. And I could imagine this could be really interestingly combined with, say, an augmented reality display, maybe a set of glasses, and things could get very, very interesting. You might have the ability to actually trigger an action when you're interacting with both physical and virtual objects. So imagine being able to reach out and actually pick up something that was virtual and touch it and have that interact with a physical surface, maybe set it down actually on a table surface, this virtual item, and you're manipulating it with your hand using this glove, and vice versa. You might be able to pick up physical objects and then have those interact with things that are in your virtual environment, including, again, maybe virtual displays that come up in some sort of augmented reality heads-up display. You could actually physically reach out and touch those things using these kinds of sensors. So Apple is definitely thinking about what is the next step for computing, what is the next thing we're going to do, and I do think it's going to be this combination of wearables, other devices, smaller screens, data in the cloud, basically having computers on us and with us in multiple forms almost all the time, and maybe moving away from, again, more traditional form factors like simply desktops or notebooks. But I don't know. What do you think about all this stuff? I thought it was pretty interesting. I think Apple's not the only company thinking about these things. I don't think this is that unique, but it was interesting to see a patent for it pop up and surface this week and kind of get a look into. The one interesting thing about patents, I think, especially ones from Apple, is we do get a little bit of insight into the things that they're thinking about for the future. Like I said, there's a lot of them, though, so you never quite know which ones are sort of making the grade internally at Apple and which ones are just there to protect them in case the technology goes in a certain direction, right? Those sort of protection kinds of patents. You never really know until maybe we get a product announcement. But nonetheless, I do think you can gain some interesting insights by looking at this stuff. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody in the tech industry who would disagree with you if you said that Apple has a killer chip design team at creating amazing, amazing processors and doing some incredible stuff. I mean, the A-series processors are best in class when it comes to so many things. And Apple also has all their cool integrated processors like the W1, which enables the technology in the AirPods, the T2 security chip. They are just killing it over there. And those chip teams have been guided by Apple's Senior Vice President of Hardware Technologies, Johnny Cerugi. And Apple's chip partner on the Mac, as you probably know, is Intel. Well, Intel, back about 7 months ago, lost their CEO when he resigned, and they've been looking for a replacement. This week, Axios claims that Apple's Cerugi is on their list. Now, we don't even know if Intel has actually reached out to Cerugi or even if he has any interest in becoming the CEO of Intel, but he did work at Intel from 1990 to 2005 before coming to Apple. He also worked at IBM. Obviously a smart guy, been around in the chip industry and the hardware industry for a while, but I find it hard to believe that he might be interested. I think this is just the kind of thing where he's on a short list maybe at Intel, but if they came calling, I think they'd have a hard time pulling him away from that incredible team over there and leading that. Now, never say never, because of course a CEO job is a lot of esteem and probably a nice bump up in pay, so I guess they could probably pull him away from Apple. But Intel, you know, if you look at what's going on with their chips, it's been pretty stale as of late. You know, little iterative improvements, not a lot of interesting, fun things going on. I guess maybe there's the potential that he could jump in there as CEO and change things up a little bit. But honestly, I can't imagine why he'd want to, again, beyond the esteem and pay, really leave Apple when they're just rocking it when it comes to chip stuff. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, they do need a CEO over there at Intel. If they can pull this guy away from Apple, I think that would be a major coup. So kudos to them if they pull it off. But again, I don't see it happening. We are pretty much expecting Apple to announce their new video streaming service sometime in 2019. I'm feeling like it's going to be this spring, so in the first half of 2019. And we've been getting a lot of news surrounding what the Apple Worldwide Video team has been up to. This week is no exception. We've got a bunch of stories coming up this week, so we're just going to kind of rapid fire through them. The first up is their deal with film studio A24. Looks like they are going to be doing a project called On the Rocks. This is according to Variety. It's going to be directed by Sofia Coppola, who is also writing the script, and it will star Bill Murray and Rashida Jones. The film is supposedly about a woman who reconnects with her Playboy father on a trip to New York, and it is apparently the first film to come out of a multi-year non-exclusive partnership deal that Apple reportedly made with A24 back in November. Another story coming out of Variety is that Jason Katims, producer of shows like Parenthood and Friday Night Lights, is reportedly leaving Universal TV after this summer, after finishing up a couple of shows that he's still on contract with them, to take on a new multi-year deal with Apple. Katims will create content for Apple under his True Jack Productions banner, and he will also be rejoining his former head of development at True Jack, Michelle Lee, who left to join join Apple's creative development team back at the beginning of December. Deadline is reporting that Apple has ordered a 10-episode season of a new sci-fi series from Simon Kinberg and David Weil. Kinberg is known for his work on the X-Men franchise, and Deadline reports that the call for the series is a, quote, large-budget, ambitious, character-driven genre show that will go into production sometime this summer. Looks like J.J. Abrams is looking to move his production company, Bad Robot, and Apple is attempting to get in on the action. They plan to go against the likes of Disney, Sony, Universal, and Warner Brothers. All the big guys are vying for the rights to produce content with Bad Robot, and I think that's of no surprise. They make some really, really great stuff. Right now, Bad Robot is under contract with Paramount, and they are reportedly paying an 8-figure overhead to have them. So whoever does end up getting Bad Robot, they are definitely going to have to pay up. And right now, J.J. Abrams doesn't have an exclusivity agreement for directing. He can kind of go wherever he wants. So this is really just about the production company, and Apple will have to step up big time. Of course, it's feeling like Disney will likely get J.J. Abrams on board, considering his connection with Star Wars and his existing relationship with Bob Iger over at Disney. So we'll have to wait and see on this one, but probably not going to end up at Apple. And then finally, in the Apple video news, Apple has reportedly done a first look deal for documentaries from Imagine Documentaries. Again, this is according to Variety. This company is formed and put together by director Ron Howard and production partner Brian Grazer. It actually is kind of a nice fit for Apple because the primary focus of Imagine Documentaries seems to be music-based films, and their most recent release was The Beatles, 8 Days a Week, The Touring Years, which actually won a 2017 Grammy for Best Music Film. So Apple's connection to music has always been very, very strong, and now that they're getting into video content, it's no surprise that they want to have the first opportunity at some of these music documentaries produced by Imagine. So that sort of rounds out the Apple video news for this week, and I'm sure we're going to have more. It seems to be heating up, right? We seem to be getting a lot more of this stuff a lot more quickly, and I think in my mind, that's a sign that we are really getting pretty close to Apple actually launching something. So I personally can't wait for that. It can't come soon enough for me. What do you think? Are you getting more excited about this? Shoot me some feedback. An email, a comment, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally in the news for this week, we did get some new hardware this week. As expected, Apple has added a new version of their battery case for the iPhone XS, XS Max, and XR to their online and retail stores. They are available now in black or white and priced at $129 US. They have a similar design to the prior generation battery cases. They do have the little bump, so if you don't like that, you're probably going to want to find a different case. But as far as I know, most people who have had the existing ones have told me they absolutely love them. They perform very, very well. Just like the prior generation, these cases do have a lightning connector, a pass-through lightning connector, so you can charge through that. But they also have the ability to charge wirelessly, so you have both options available to you. Some early reports of these battery cases, if you read them, you might have heard that they have a smaller milliamp hour capacity and that they had less battery life than the prior generations. That is not true because they actually have higher voltage, so the total watt hours is actually higher, even though it's less milliamp hours in the spec. So don't be fooled by that. You actually do get more battery life than the prior generation with the new versions of the battery case. As a matter of fact, Apple says you can expect between 47 to 75% more usage time depending upon your phone model and how you use it. The reports also claim that you can use the new XS battery case with your iPhone X, but you do need to update to iOS 12.1.3. And I say that you can. There does still seem to be a little bit of confusion. Some reports saying that you might get an incompatibility pop-up when using it with an iPhone X, but that it does seem to work just fine after you dismiss that pop-up. So you have that. Also, you do have the fact that there are some slight design changes between the iPhone X and XS, things like the camera bump being off just a hair, so the fit isn't quite right. I would say that you have, if you have an iPhone X, you probably want to look for a different battery case, and you know, just stick with this one if you own an iPhone XS, XS Max, or XR. But that's the new hardware for this week, and with that, that rounds out the news for this episode of the MacCast. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a couple show sponsors, starting with ExpressVPN. You know, with the recent news about online security breaches, I think it's hard not to worry about where our data is going. Making an online purchase or simply accessing your email could put your private information at risk. And even beyond using public or unsecured Wi-Fi, social media websites, marketing companies, mobile and internet service providers, they're finding ways to track us each and every day. And not only can they record our browser history, but they often even sell that information to corporations who want to profit from it. Now, a great way to take your privacy back is with ExpressVPN. I've actually been using it, and it makes it easy for me to protect my data and my privacy. That's because the app runs seamlessly in the background, and it literally takes just a click to turn it on. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet traffic by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. And when you use public Wi-Fi and want to keep hackers and spies from seeing your data, ExpressVPN is the solution you want. ExpressVPN is rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar, and it comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. And you can start protecting yourself with ExpressVPN for less than $7 a month. So protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at ExpressVPN/MacCast. That's ExpressVPN.com/MacCast for 3 months free with a 1-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/MacCast to learn more. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I'd also like to thank and tell you about Mack Weldon. You know, Mack Weldon, they sell the most comfortable socks, underwear, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and more that you are ever going to wear. That's because they believe in smart designs, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. Actually, browsing their website, I can tell you it is a great experience. It is really well designed. It's easy to find what you're looking for, even though they have a huge variety of styles and colors all there, but it's really not too overwhelming. I actually ordered a couple crew neck t-shirts, and the feel and quality of the fabric is just incredible. It's so soft and comfortable. I absolutely love them. I also ordered a couple of their everyday extended crew socks, and those are great as well. And best of all, they take Apple Pay. So checkout was a complete breeze. A couple taps on my Apple Watch, and I was done. And they want you to be comfortable. So if you don't like your first pair of underwear, you can keep it, and they will still refund you, no questions asked. Best of all, you can get 20% off your first order if you visit MacWeldon.com and enter the promo code MacCast. That's MacWeldon.com, MacWeldon.com, and be sure to use the coupon code MacCast for 20% off your first order. I think you're going to love their stuff, and a big thank you to Mack Weldon for their support of the MacCast. I want to tell you about a new piece of technology I got over the holidays, something that I'm actually pretty excited about, a record player. Yeah, I know it's not really new technology, but it's new for me technology, at least for new for me recently. I had a record player way back in the day when I was a kid, and that meant I also had a bunch of old records lying around, and I really have been wanting to listen to those records again, but I didn't have anything to play them on. So for Christmas, I finally bought myself one of these little cheap suitcase-style players that you can get online, and it's not great quality, but it doesn't sound too bad. It's got little built-in speakers, and it allowed me to at least play the records and hear them again. So that was kind of job well done. But I was sitting around and looking at it, and the particular model that I bought actually has a couple of RCA line-out jacks on the side of it. And I think the idea is that you can use those to then convert your vinyl records into another format, right? So either record them onto tape, I guess, or more likely probably bring them into your computer. As a matter of fact, I know there's some record players that you can get that also have USB connections on them, so you can go right into your computer. So they have a digital to an analog to digital converter built right into them. But in this one, it didn't have that. But it did start to get me wondering, you know, is there a way, because the built-in speakers weren't that great, I was wondering, is there a way I could use that RCA line out to actually play it another way? You know, I knew I could do it through a set of speakers, but ideally what I really wanted to do was play it through my HomePod. So I thought, how can I make this happen? And I came up with a solution, and I wanted to share that with you. So it turns out, yes, you can hook up a record player or another kind of device to your HomePod. You need a couple of things, though. You will need, if you're doing a record player that has line out, or like I said, better yet, USB audio out. And if you don't have line out, you're going to need a USB audio interface or a Thunderbolt one. And then finally, and this is really the key to the whole thing, is you need a copy of Airfoil from Rogue Amoeba. And I will have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically what Airfoil does is allows you to take audio from any source and actually send it over AirPlay to an AirPlay device. Since the HomePod is an AirPlay device, this works great for that. So the whole setup ended up actually being pretty easy. I just had to connect my record player to my Mac using my USB audio interface. So I went from those RCA jacks to a quarter inch plug that plugged right into my Zoom H4 Handy Recorder, which is the same USB audio interface that I use for recording the podcast. So I actually just went into the second line because it actually has two line inputs, and then I can switch back and forth. So I can switch between using the one for my mic to record the podcast or switch over to line two now, which is now hooked up to my record player. And so at that point, I have audio coming into USB on my computer, USB audio, and it's selectable as an input source. And so then all I had to do was install and run Airfoil. And then inside the Airfoil software, I could pick the USB audio of the record player as my source, and then I could pick any of my AirPlay targets, which included my HomePod. So I just selected input USB audio, which is the record player, output to the HomePod, and bing, bang, boom, I was listening to amazing audio from my record player over my HomePod. And it sounded so much better. And of course, you don't have to have a HomePod to do this. Any output source for AirPlay would do. So if you have a set of AirPlay speakers, that would work as well. If you have something hooked up to your Apple TV, you could send the audio to your Apple TV. And you could also send it to any Mac, PC, or any other device running the Airfoil satellite application. So that basically, the Airfoil satellite app will turn your Mac, your PC into an AirPlay destination. So you could do it that way as well. And like I said, the sound sounded pretty good. It wasn't perfect. And luckily, Airfoil, the application, also has a built-in equalizer so you can actually sweeten up the audio from your record player as well a little bit if needed. And for mine, it just needed a little bit of bass boost. And I know that sounds weird knowing that the HomePod actually is pretty big on the deep end, but it did need a little bit more bass to give it a little more sort of range. And I don't know if that's just because of the nature of records and how recordings were done back then. It's been a while since I listened to that kind of music, but it was really fun. This was a fun little experiment, something to play around with. There might be some other solutions for it or other ways to do it. Like I said, probably the biggest thing would be get a record player that actually has the USB built in, and that kind of saves having to have the extra audio interface. But overall, I loved it. I was able to actually listen to my record and do it through my HomePod. So that was pretty cool, and I wanted to share that with you this week. This next item actually came up on the MacCast Patreon Slack channel. If you'd like to support the MacCast through Patreon, that's something that you can do. You can check out and get more information on how to do that by visiting patreon.com/MacCast. But occasionally what happens in there is we have a Mac help channel and an iOS help channel, and so people will ask questions and we'll try to help each other out with answers to those. This week one came up that I thought was worth sharing, and that is a interesting thing or a dilemma that comes into play with Spotlight sometimes, and you may have noticed this on your own Mac. So you're doing a Spotlight search for a contact or maybe a calendar item, and for whatever reason, Spotlight is returning duplicate entries. So you're expecting to see one entry, and you're actually seeing two, and it can be a little bit annoying and a little bit frustrating. And there can be a couple of reasons why this happens, but I think the most common is you end up having data that is local being on my Mac, and then also data that is synced through one of your services, whether you're using Google Calendar or Google Contacts or iCloud syncing, whatever it might be, you have entries in both places, and that ends up being why you see duplicates. And the way you can check if this is what the problem is by opening either the contacts or the calendar application and then looking in the sidebar and seeing if you have iCloud and on my Mac options. And if you do, you can click between those two sections and you can see what data is in each one of those. And typically at the top, especially I know in the contacts application, there is an all contacts option. And if you click on that, you will see the data both from iCloud and from on my Mac. I guess you could also have two different syncing services. So if you're syncing through iCloud and Google, sometimes you can end up with sources from, you know, the same entries in both those places, and you'll want to clean that up as well. So I typically go into contacts, I click on all contacts. If I see duplicates, I'll click on the all iCloud option and notice if they go away, and then also click on the all on my Mac option, and you can kind of weed things out that way. It's pretty much the same thing over in the calendar. So if you do want to clean things up and get this data cleaned up, the first bit of advice I would give you is make sure that you do a backup, because you are going to be messing with your calendar and contact data. And, you know, nothing should happen, but if something would happen, you wouldn't want to lose any of that data. So go ahead and make sure you have a backup. Probably the easiest way to do that is to go in and into the on my Mac versions, select any of them, and then under the file menu, use the export option to back up that existing data. And both the calendar and contact sections have an archive option. So just save it in the contact archive format or the calendar archive format. And I would just do the whole set of duplicate data, so on my Mac, but you could select individual records or individual groups of records if you want to do it that way. Doesn't really matter. The point is, make sure that you get it backed up. Also, just for safety, I would say make sure you have a recent like full backup of your system, which is actually going to back up the data in its location inside your library folder as well. But once you have your backup done, then you should be able to go in safely and delete or remove any duplicate records from the On My Mac data sections. So make sure you're clicking into that section and just delete or remove your data there. Another more extreme version of this is you could go find the actual data files in your library and just delete those entirely and then turn off, or actually you'd want to do this beforehand, you'd want to turn off iCloud syncing, go in and delete that data, then relaunch the application, turn iCloud syncing back on, and let it sync back up. But I prefer not removing the already synced iCloud data if you can avoid it. So I would start by just removing the local data within the application itself and then seeing if that doesn't fix the problem. I do think maybe even after doing this, though, you might want to do a full backup and also turn off calendar and contact syncing inside iCloud and turn it back on again. If you want to do that, you can do that from the system preferences under iCloud. So you can check that out. And then the only other thing I could think of related to this is you might want to go in and review contact and calendar syncing and just double check and see if you are using multiple services or not. And you can check which services are syncing by going into System Preferences into the Internet accounts and then clicking on each individual account. So if you have iCloud accounts, maybe multiple iCloud accounts, and you have Google accounts and maybe even other kinds of accounts, maybe your internet service provider provides you emails and calendar syncing as well, you can turn all of those on or off. Now, my preference personally is to have one source of data. So I use iCloud for syncing everything, even though I do have Google accounts. I don't do any of my calendars or contacts through that Google account. Now, you could have multiples, and you can have multiples turned on, but recognize that if you do have duplicates in there, you probably are going to see duplicate data when you're doing searching on your Mac, or at least within the applications themselves. If you've clicked on the All option, so, you know, like all of my contacts, you're going to see contacts from Google and from iCloud intermixed with each other, and it will look like you have duplicate contacts. The way around that is to make sure that when you're looking at any individual account, that you're only looking at the contacts for that account and not overall for the entire application. So I would just say, you know, you might want to consider, if you're using multiple accounts, merging all of the contacts and calendar items into one source of truth, either Google or iCloud, whatever it might be, and then turn off syncing for the other account. I think it just personally makes it simpler, but you may have different reasons or needs for what you're doing. And I just wanted to bring that up because I do think that's confusing for some people. Sometimes people set up multiple accounts, they'll be syncing data across those multiple accounts, and then they'll see those duplicates and think that they have duplicate data, but you really don't. It's just different information for different syncing services. So I thought that was a great question that popped up on the Slack, and thought it'd be great to address here on the general MacCast as well. Something we talked about and covered recently here on the MacCast was what to do to sort of prepare an old Mac for getting ready to sell or give away or move into recycling. Basically, how do we clean off any of our data that might be on that system? And we went through a bunch of tips and tricks, but one thing that I didn't talk about was the NVRAM or the PRAM in your system. You know, from the old days, it's PRAM, and in newer models, it's the non-volatile RAM. And James wrote in to remind me about that, and he said one of the reasons he was bringing it up was that he had had an experience where he had wiped a Mac clean, and then after reboot, it was still connecting to his home Wi-Fi network without asking for his credentials. And he had heard that that information might be stored in the non-volatile RAM, and that that might be another area where you want to make sure you clear out the data so that information isn't in there. I had not heard that that information was stored there, and I was actually pretty sure that it wasn't. So I did a little bit of my own research. We went back and forth on email and basically confirmed that that data must have been coming from someplace else. I'm not really sure where it would have come from. Maybe I know iOS devices and Macs running the latest version of the operating system can share network information or Wi-Fi information across devices, although I think they all still need to be tied into the same iCloud account. So I don't know if James had set up iCloud and then that information was coming across. I don't really know, but it shouldn't be there in a freshly wiped Mac, not stored in the non-volatile RAM at least. But just having that email exchange, and I do think, you know, just clearing the NVRAM as part of that cleanup process of an old Mac, it can't hurt. It's going to get rid of some extraneous information. But it did start me wondering, what is that information? What exactly is stored in the non-volatile RAM on your Mac? And it turns out there's actually a terminal command that you can run to get a list of most, not everything, because some of the items are meant to be sort of protected, but you can run a command in the terminal, and I will put it in the show notes at maccast.com. But if you go into the terminal and type nvram-p or and it's actually space dash, so nvram space dash p or nvram space dash xp, it will print out a list of some current items that are in your non-volatile RAM. Of course, not everything, but it'll give you a general sense of what's in there. And I have a full list in the show notes at maccast.com, so if you do want to know everything that's in there, you can go read through that. But I thought I'd point out just a couple of items that I sort of found interesting. So there is the backlight level on your Mac is stored in there. Some of the Bluetooth information, so like the active Bluetooth controller information is in there. You've got a bunch of different boot arguments, so things that would happen at boot up. There is stuff related to the system integrity protection. Also, your display configurations, a whole bunch of EFI boot firmware information, user IDs, your computer name, graphics, GPU card policy, so which GPU is currently active and it wants the system to use, things like the audio volume, so what is the current decibel level that your volume is set to. So all of that information and stuff can come back when you reboot your Mac. All of that stuff is stored in there. And so, of course, you can reset it. You can clear it out. To do that, it's pretty easy. You hold down the Command, Option, P, and R keys when you're booting up your Mac. If you have a Mac without a T2 chip, you're going to want to hold those down through 2 startup cycles. So you should wait to hear the startup chime twice, and then you can release those and let your Mac start up as normal, and that will have cleared out the non-volatile RAM. If you have an older Mac, it's called the PRAM or the parameter RAM. If you have a Mac with a T2 chip in it, one of the newer MacBook Pros, for example, or the new MacBook Air, you want to hold down those keys, Command Option PR, until you see the white Apple logo appear and disappear twice. Once it disappears twice, you can release those keys and let your Mac start up as normal. And that will have cleared out the RAM. And because of that, one other thing you might want to do after that is open up your system preferences and go back and adjust any of your settings that might have been reset. Things like your sound volume, your display resolution, any startup disks that you had selected, or even your time zone. That's another one of those things that is stored in your non-volatile RAM. So lots of little things stored in there, but not your Wi-Fi credentials or password, which is a good thing. But still, nonetheless, I thought that was great, a great recommendation by James that, hey, here's another little thing that you might want to just clean up and clear out if you're getting ready to sell or repurpose an older Mac. And then finally, for today. I did receive something we were talking about on previous episode of the MacCast was augmented reality applications, basically AR kit apps. And I had mentioned, you know, there's a lot of gimmicky ones out there, like little games and things that are fun, but maybe not really practical and all that useful. And we did have a practical recommendation, and I was hoping to get a few more of those from you. So I asked you, hey, if you know of a cool little application that is using a augmented reality or AR kit, it doesn't even have to be a little one, it could be a big application, let us know about it. And Dale wrote in this week with what I thought was a great recommendation, especially if you're someone who enjoys the outdoors, you like to go hiking or camping, but even if you just live in an area where you've got mountains around you, he recommends an application called Peak Finder, and I will link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically what this does is this allows you to take your phone or your iPad, anything that supports ARKit, hold it up, and then it uses the compass and the GPS data and other information along with augmented reality to show you the names of all of the mountains and mountain peaks that are around you, and it actually points them out in a full 360-degree panorama display. And according to the website, it knows more than 650,000 peaks from all over the world, and it should be able to identify those. And Dale says this application has worked well for him, and so it looks like a nifty little app, and it is using Apple's ARKit and augmented reality. It's $4.99 US on the App Store, and you can pick that up. Again, the name of the application, Peak Finder. And big thanks to Dale for sending in that recommendation. So we are still looking for more of these. If you do have a great augmented reality application, it can be something fun. It can be a game that you dislike, but I'm really kind of looking more for a more unique uses. I think a lot of games can take advantage of augmented reality, but I'm curious what other ways various applications are taking advantage of augmented reality and ARKit. We had talked about that basketball game, that basketball application that will actually help analyze your free throw shooting and your dribbling and those sorts of things. That is out and available on the Mac App Store, and it was recommended by another listener. So if you have one of these, shoot me an email, an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for today. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And then finally, if you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.